Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Pierre Baldi. He's professor of information and computer science at University of California at Irvine. He's the director of their Institute for Genomics and Bioinformatics. He specializes in bioinformatics and computational biology, data mining and machine learning, and communication networks. He's the author, most recently, of Bioinformatics, The Machine Learning Approach, and The Shattered Self, The End of Natural Evolution. Welcome, Dr. Baldi.
Thank you.
Now, your book, the principal theme of your book is that the self, our traditional understandings of life more generally, is being deconstructed at the hands of biotechnological advances. But I struggled with that concept because, to me, the self is really a bundle of ideas and memories which floats and is held together by an illusion of self-awareness in people's brains. And you only seem to touch tangentially on how technology might be actually challenging or deconstructing that internal self as opposed to our kind of attachment to our physical uniqueness.
You are right to some extent. I think the notion of internal self is extremely complex and not well understood. So I tried in my book not to go too far into speculations, although I'm very interested in the topic, and to try to confine the analysis to things that were occurring already in our current society and probably in the near future.
So
I think we can start tinkering with the internal self maybe in 1,000 years or something in that range. To me would seem conceivable, perhaps earlier. But it's a little bit premature to try to guess what could happen there, because we really have no real definition of the internal self, if you want, or understanding of consciousness, self-awareness, and all those things.
Well, we'll get back to how long it will take for us to tinker with the internal self in a second, but one of the things that commentators, that your book is particularly strong on, and the commentators have certainly noticed about it, is that because of your background in bioinformatics, your back-of-the-tablecloth calculations about the different orders of magnitude of information involved in the body and what it would take to replicate or to model the body and the mind, that's a very valuable contribution in your book. And you talk about, for instance, the body being replicable in the order of 10 to the 18 bits. When you are doing that calculation, are you thinking about the creation of a model of biological structure in a machine that would therefore allow us to recreate or to store bodies and our biological being?
Well, there are different so-called back-of-the-envelope calculations in the book. I think the one you are referring to, something in the range of 10 to the 18, is more like the total number of bits of all the things that transpire through us through a lifetime. So what I call in the book the external self. In other words, if you were to record all the things you say, see, hear, and do throughout your life, you would get something in that range.
So all of our sensed data as well as
actions. All your data, all your actions is definitely something that could be recorded and stored on current technologies. It's a big amount, but it's doable.
So if we were to try to record all of our ocular information on videotape and all of our auditory information on CD-ROM or something like that, those are the kinds of
correct
amounts.
You could imagine having sensors on your muscles, on your legs, on your arms, and then you could keep track of all your movements throughout your life.
Mm-hmm. Now, so what motivated you to perform that calculation? I mean, what are the applications?
What motivated me was exactly your starting point, this problem with the internal self, which we don't know very well how to define. So I try to define the external self, which is a very simple thing to define in a procedural way, everything you see, do, hear throughout your life, and show that at least the external self is recordable, storable, postable on your website, and so on and so forth. And That already, which is doable today, I think somewhat starts challenging a little bit your notions of self and mortality and so on. I'd like to point to you that if you take your best friend, all you know of your best friend is the external self. So when you have the external self of a person, you should have a feeling that you know that person pretty well, although we have a feeling that we're different from our external self. But for the external world, for the other people, that's all they have access to.
Now, when you turn yourself to the discussion of the internal self, you argue that the complexity of our memories and the internal structure of our brain is so great that the order of magnitude jumps from 10 to the 18th to 10 to the 27th in terms of the amount of information that would be necessary to capture. There is a scientist named Ray Kurzweil, who's a computational scientist, a computer scientist. He argues that eventually we will have nanotechnology, a kind of network of nanotechnology inside our head, monitoring and communicating with all of our neurons, and that might in fact be the kind of system that would enable us to capture this 10 to the 27th information. What about the idea of nanotechnology that's capable of creating a neural human interface? Do you foresee that within a certain time frame?
Well, you're already starting to see, at least in the laboratories, the first interfaces between neurons and, say, silicon devices and artificial cochlea, artificial retina, artificial noses. All those things exist in university laboratories to different degrees of development. So you definitely can see the beginning of that. But we're very far from being able to remove one piece of a brain and replace it by an artificial construct. 10 to the 27 again is a very rough number. It's derived by defining the internal self in terms of the neural activity between your neurons throughout a lifetime and trying to get an estimate of the amount of bits that are involved in that activity. It's definitely conceivable that...
So it's not a snapshot. 10 to the 27th is not a snapshot of what's happening.
No, it's over a lifetime. But calculating things over a lifetime is a small factor in this business. So if you can do it over a few seconds, it will be easy to scale things to an entire lifetime. It's a factor maybe of a billion or something like that. But
to actually capture, say I'm at the point of death, wouldn't it be sufficient to capture all of the neurological complexity inside my brain at that particular second in order for me to have a sense of continuity rather than necessarily having to capture everything that happened in my life?
Well, absolutely. If you want to have the continuity from that point in time on, that is what you would have to do. Or, again, assuming, taking a materialist position, that everything is basically recorded in the matter of your brain. But again, there you need something more than just the electric activity of that point in time. What you have to store is also the molecular state of the neurons, of all the synapses, because that's where the memories, that's who you are, is believed to reside. So it's more than the electrical activity. And so if you start going to all the molecules, or at least all the large molecules, the proteins in the brain, then you get numbers that could be even higher than 10 to the 27.
Oh, that's depressing. So you talk about the idea of immortality, and you talk about the fact that Moore's law, the geometric progression of computing power, and of other human capacities as well, will eventually converge with these numbers, 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 27th, information storage capacities. So you're not ultimately pessimistic. You're pointing out that the numbers may be very large, but ultimately we're going to get there with human technology, given everything being constant.
Yes, conceivably, but I think this idea of pessimistic or optimistic or wanting to be mortal is something a little bit of the past, that over the long time, if you let me really speculate about a long-term future, I think will become completely moot and not be relevant in some sense.
Well, that's a good place to transition, because your argument about the self itself becoming problematic, that I have a Buddhist background, and one of the central insights of Buddhism is that the self is an illusion, that we don't need to be unhappy about death because our sense of continuity of self is in fact itself an illusion. Is that what you're getting at?
Yes, that is what I would start getting at from a more scientific angle. But yes, I have some speculation, some ideas go in that direction.
If we were able to capture and record some of our memories, thoughts, perceptions, and put them out on our website, is your suggestion that ultimately we would realize that we should be just as happy that people have shared our thoughts, memories, feelings in this deep and intimate way, and that we don't need as a particular constellation of those to continue ourselves? Is that the nature of the acceptance that you foresee?
Well, that is one, but there are other issues. There could be, for instance, it could be that there is some kind of information space that exists out there that we don't really understand at this point in time, where possibly all possible existence, the one you have had, the one you could have had, are just points in this information space. And in this information space, the notion of mortality would not be really relevant or meaningful.
Because?
Because all the possibilities are living simultaneously in that sort of information space. Oh. And you have been just a sample of this space in at a given time with a material realization. But that's all there is to it.
Let's take it to another set of wild speculations. Werner Vinge is a mathematician, science fiction writer, and again, Ray Kurzweil, the computer scientist, and a number of other people have begun to talk about what happens when these technological trends, these geometric technological trends reach a point sometime in the next 30, 40 years at which, for instance, computers become self-aware. Human beings begin to take geometric leaps in intelligence ourselves, and they refer to that as a singularity. Do you believe that there's going to be some kind of discontinuity in social and technological development as these trends begin to geometrically kick forth? I mean, if every 18 months all information doubles or computational power doubles, then things could begin to happen very quickly.
I definitely believe that we are in a sort of period of very fast transition. What does it mean exactly that it's continuous or discontinuous? If you want to really probe that concept, I think one would be hard pressed. And I also, if there was some kind of slight discontinuity, I don't think it will happen as fast as, say, in 20 years or 30 years. Things are moving fast, but not that fast. So we see that with the Human Genome Project, for instance, or with computers. We're still far from having computers that have sort of human-like capabilities in spite of progress and many decades of efforts.
I've been speaking with Professor Pierre Baldi. He's in information and computer science at the University of California at Irvine, author of Bioinformatics, The Machine Learning Approach, and The Shattered Self, The End of Natural Evolution. We hope to have you back someday, Professor Baldi.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm speaking now with Dionne Farquhar. She's the author of The Other Machine, Discourse and Reproductive Technologies, and many other articles about the topic of reproductive technologies and feminism. Welcome, Dionne.
Thank you, James.
Your problematique over the last decade or two of your work has been, as I understand it, to challenge some feminist essentialist notions around the maternal, which tend to keep feminists from embracing technological liberatory opportunities. Is that correct?
That's basically correct. Should I go on and amplify
Please.
From there?
Amplify.
Okay.
Dilate, as we say.
I would say that, you know, my work is an attempt to steer a third path and to interrogate the existing two positions, which I see as, on the one hand, essentialisms and fundamentalisms, which cluster together, you know, are fundamentalisms, but they're fundamentalisms of the right and fundamentalisms of the left, particularly feminist fundamentalisms. And I take issue with these two fundamentalisms, religious, secular, and feminist political ones of the left, in my book, The Other Machine. I'm also concerned about the inadequacy of liberal state and the liberal state regulatory apparatus and mechanisms to provide a framework for understanding, appropriating, and resisting contemporary reproductive technologies, which only grow with importance, with use, with income generated, with market visibility.
Have you caught a lot of flack?
Yes and no. There is, unfortunately, a kind of incommensurability between the feminists who disagree with each other, and that we're normally not in dialogue with each other. Conferences like this put people who are what I would say essentially liberals on the one hand, and people who are who have essentialist tendencies of very good intentions in terms of worried about both national and global human rights abuses, and suspicion, other people who are suspicious about market abuses, and put us in dialogue with each other. But as James and I were saying just before this radio interview, you have these panels, and we only lay the groundwork to get started, and it's over. And it requires, you know, more talking, more thinking, more cross-fertilizations, more, you know, more emails, more, you know, web and in-person conferences. Of, you know, so that's one of the reasons I'm participating here, is to kind of get the word out that there's, this is an essentially contested domain and territory, and you know, I'm for intelligent argument and debate, but I think we can't be afraid of saying that we have competing epistemes, meaning systems of knowledge, competing ontologies, competing accounts of the way things are in the world, and competing visions, really differing and contested visions of what the future should look like and what's adequate and what's not adequate, what's even intolerable about present social, economic, and political structures.
Mm-hmm. Let me propose that we both come out of a socialist feminist background. And I think that out of the socialist feminist experience and also out of the general social democratic experience, there may be a set of problems that we have, a set of things that we bring to the table of this debate that make us sensitive in ways that others don't. And let me give you a concrete example. Here, you, in this book, in your The Other Machine, you quote Rosalind Pacheski, who's a prominent feminist critic of biotechnology. She says, having choices that are real involves changing the world. Okay. Something we both probably agree with. I agree with it. The problem is that people like Pacheski and many others involved in the critique about reproductive technologies take the next step and say, because people don't have real choices, they say, they critique bourgeois democracy and bourgeois liberalism, and they say people don't have real choices. Because they don't have real choices, we need to restrict their choices and restrict their use of their false consciousness, which is going to get them into trouble, and take them in some direction to take their choices away. And I think that's where people like ourselves who come out of a tradition critical of authoritarian socialism, immediately that raises our hackles. You think it's right?
I think that's completely right, James. And what I would add to that is that while we may come out of a tradition, the new left, critical of the old left and the authoritarian aspects of the old left, people from my generation, I'm a bit older than James here, from the generation of 1968, I would say that the first 10 years of my politicized path in my throughout my 20s, I would say, which coincided with that moment of 1968, say until 1980, that moment was exceedingly, despite its knee-jerk and deep and real anti-authoritarianism, was also filled with a kind of secular moralism. And that secular moralism continues to capture, if not infect, the left and many progressive movements. There is no Archimedean position or revolutionary perch from which one is purer or knows or does not have some degree of, in other words, all we have is varying positionalities that are more or less false consciousnesses. So that I formally took the position was, so, well, the workers have false consciousness, they don't see what their true interests are, and all this consumerism, and they want to, you know, and when I heard when the Berlin Wall went down in 89, and East Berliners were, you know, collecting their $50 from the West Berlin government and buying VCRs. And I heard leftist friends of mine at conferences denounce, imagine the crassness, the materialism, they want a VCR. And these friends had at least one, if not two, VCRs already in 89. And I thought, well, mazel tov, they want a VCR like everybody else, you know, understandably. Let's not moralize about their consumerism from even the American academic Spartan and Puritan levels of consumption. So what I want to say is that Marxism and feminism have shared a very unacknowledged and underacknowledged moralistic heritage that that would tell people what is good for them. And in this respect, liberalism, for all of, you know, its market, the monstrosity of the market and its historical abuses, liberalism does not, it tries to safeguard, the capaciousness of liberalism tries to safeguard what is ultimately what people decide is in their best interests. And it is particularly galling to me that feminists will say, well, it's overdetermined, natalism is certainly overdetermined for women, and women standing in line to have invasive, harmful technologies and to pay very highly, literally, figuratively and literally for these technologies is problematic. But the way to fight this, to inform about this, and to create other options, which I try to suggest in my paper, so that having a child was not the only benchmark of being a real woman. And this is complex. This is, as Trotsky said about abolishing the family, you don't just abolish the family, you know? I mean, it's not simple. You don't abolish natalism. So where I'm going with this is to say that the elitism and the Archimedean perch from which Marxists and now feminists say we know what's better for women, and what is better for women is resisting and not standing in line at, say, the IVF clinics, is ultimately contemptuous of what actual real-world women are choosing through much anguish, through much consideration. Most of these people are second mortgaging their house, borrowing, you know, hell, going through hell. They're not just rich.
They see it when Afghan feminists or Afghan women say, you know, we want to stay in the burqa. And then they say, well, I can't understand how you could possibly want to stay in the burqa. But, you know, they're at least willing to sit down and have that conversation. But they're not willing to have that conversation with Western women.
They're willing to have that conversation about the veil, about female genital mutilation, but not about ourselves, which is truly, you know, I think the limits of what has been called falsely cultural relativism, which is not cultural relativism, but which is a politics of difference that can understand how the veil may be less than the way it looks to us, which is completely oppressive for them, and to understand their context, as well as for female genital, even female genital mutilation, has its context and its priority. And the women who succeed in working against it succeed in understanding and changing the context of status, power, economic distribution, you know, and so forth.
The current context, of course, is incredibly repressive. We've got Leon Cass and
read Leon Cass. I have. I read Leon Cass.
It's 13th century bioethics.
Well, I love it.
And he has assembled. He's stacked the deck of the president's commission with a bunch of very well acknowledged intellectuals, but all of whom basically agree with him on the fundamentals. So you know, it seems like a very dark period for. For people like us.
For progressive political people, yeah.
Yeah. So, yet I have a certain faith in the American public in that their selfishness, whenever the American public is polled about whether, yeah, you're opposed to X, but if X was actually available and it would actually help you, would you use it? How? Yes,
oh, yeah,
I'd use it.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that as these technologies come to the fore, that the contradictions between whatever the repressive regime is and the reasons for it coming into being, which is basically right to life politics, and the public's desire to benefit, to live longer and be healthier and all that.
Well, I wish I shared your optimism.
You're not as optimistic.
I'm not as optimistic at this small window of optimism that I see open here, only because I've seen the American electorate, I mean, that 51% that even bothers to vote, which is noteworthy in itself. But that majority that continues to vote for, you know, what I consider mean-spirited, have no fun, you know, take it away, Republicans, you know, and with a capacity for a rapaciousness and a greed beyond which I can fathom, you know, just barely having climbed into the middle class myself, you know. I worry about the mean-spiritedness in the U.S., the snoopiness, the concern about the next person's behavior, and the worry that the next person might be having some fun or more fun than the examiner is having.
I mean, another reason for my optimism is that I think when the boomers retire and they have all that free time, they're going to want to legalize pot, they're going to want to expand the welfare state, all the things that have been on my agenda for a long time.
Socialized medicine. Bring us triple Social Security benefits.
Right.
And so.
Some of them may want to have babies, so they'll legalize 60-year-old women getting access to ReproTech. What is your current project? Are you working on a writing project of some kind?
Well, I'm also a poet and a fiction writer, and I always have, I'm in a poetry group at home in Santa Cruz, and I'm always both revising and generating new material, and as you can imagine, I write what's called close to language poetry or, postmodern poetry, and the same is true of my prose fiction, which is not short stories, but militantly prose fiction, which is about anything. People like myself, with my generation's commitments to equalizing and redistributing power relations, as well as having some fun in the process, and trying to live a decent life and intervene where possible. But not to the point of, complete sacrifice. And
you haven't been attracted to speculative fiction?
Yes, I have been attracted to science fiction, and I just have not had the time to pursue that corpus. Mm-hmm. I think I would like some of what I read about it. I read some of the criticism, and there are some works I'd like to read more. Of course, the seminal stuff like Neuromancer and, mm-hmm. The Pat Cadigan stuff I like very much. But I don't write so much in that vein as about people's contemporary relationships and problems and resolutions and pessimisms and making do and struggles and so forth. But
yeah, your work really talks a lot about the discursive and cultural imagery that's used in the ReproTech industry and mm-hmm. around the maternal and so forth, like Emily Martin's work, I guess you've mm-hmm. been in dialogue with.
Yeah.
Do you try to play with any of those tropes in your work?
Yeah, in my I have an essay on called Pedestrian Gamete Donation, Pedestrian Cry, in an anthology called Playing Dolly, Technocultural Formations, which I'd recommend to readers who are interested. And there I play with the metaphoricity of mobile sperm and captive eggs. I think a lot more has to be done on the role of metaphoricity and the difficulty of transcending it. People spoke today about martial and military and war metaphors, and disease and,
Something I've been very concerned about is the way that the metaphors of bad science fiction constrain all of our thinking. People just use 1984 or Brave New World as if it's an end of discussion. It's like bringing up Hitler in a conversation. Oh, well, if it's associated with that, then it couldn't possibly be good. But when you break it down, Brave New World, okay, they had perfect drugs that didn't harm your health and just made you happy. They had control over reproduction, granted, to create a classist society, which isn't good, but they had perfect control over reproduction. They were able to educate kids in a non-labor-intensive way just by, talking to them in their sleep. If you break down the technologies and Brave New World, they're not inherently bad. So.
But I certainly object to the hated mantra of Brave New World, 1984, and the third one is Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Because again, Frankenstein, taking parts, and this woman, Mary Shelley, basically said, let me make my own man, and I applaud this,
Right.
So in terms of answering the question of what's on the burner now, I want to do some stuff on disability.
Disabled people are the transhuman pioneers because they're the ones who have the most interest and are using technologies in really innovative ways. They're becoming cyborgs, virtuality, cyborgization of their body, technology dependence.
Exactly. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I want to pursue that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.